Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
New fighting breaks out in Somalia. An aid group says it will take 6 months to get the Ebola epidemic under control. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington. Heavy fighting broke out in the Somali capital today when government and African Union forces attacked a militia loyal to a former warlord. Witnesses and officials say at least 10 people were killed in the fighting in the Wadajir neighborhood in southwest Mogadishu. Residents of the neighborhood told VOA they heard unusually heavy gunfire and explosions during the fight. Gunmen suspected of being Boko Haram militants have kidnapped around 100 people from villages in far northeastern Nigeria near the shores of Lake Chad. Witnesses say the gunmen raided villages Sunday in the remote Dora Baga region of Borno State, where they rounded up civilians and set houses on fire. They said at least 26 people were killed during the attack. The witnesses spoke to journalists today. There was no initial claim of responsibility for the attack. The head of a medical aid group says the Ebola outbreak in West Africa is moving faster than relief workers can respond to it. Doctors Without Borders president Joanne Liu says the situation in the affected countries feels like wartime because of fear over the virus. The Associated Press says an unnamed Egyptian government official puts the death toll in the latest violence between supporters and opponents of ousted President Mohamed Morsi at 2. Other reports indicate the number may be 3. The official said today's fighting between protesters happened in the Giza district of Cairo and that 4 policemen were wounded. The Associated Press says dozens of riot police raided the offices of a newspaper critical of the government. A police spokesman was quoted as saying he was worried that the paper could cause confusion at a time when the government is trying to cope with the Ebola outbreak. The National Chronicle and its publisher, Philibert Brown, accused President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf of corruption. Police officials tried to detain Brown during the raid. He has been ordered to report for questioning. The Associated Press reports Olympic and government officials are banning 3 athletes from the area of Africa affected by the Ebola virus from competing in the Youth Olympics. The games are scheduled to begin Saturday in the Chinese city of Nanjing. All athletes from 4 West African nations will be required to leave their temperature or have their temperatures taken regularly and undergo physical assessments. The 3 who are banned were to take part in combat or aquatic events, sports in which no athletes from Ebola areas will be allowed to compete for safety reasons. Thousands of people have held protest rallies, across the United States in remembrance of a black teenager fatally shot by a police officer in the state of Missouri. Vigils were held in nearly 100 cities Thursday, observing a moment of silence for 18-year-old Michael Brown. Pope Francis today said Mass in front of tens of thousands of South Korean young people. He urged them to renounce the materialism found in much of Asia and to reject what he called inhuman economic systems that disenfranchise the poor. Russia has denied reports that a column of Russian military vehicles crossed into Ukraine late Thursday and was destroyed by Ukrainian troops. A spokesman for Russia's defense ministry told reporters for Russian news outlets no Russian military convoy had crossed into Ukraine. The Ukrainian government says a military column from Russia did cross into eastern Ukraine. The office of Ukraine's president, Petro Poroshenko, posted on its website that Ukraine destroyed a significant portion of the military column. Emerging from a meeting on Friday, European Union ministers issued a statement urging Russia to put an immediate stop to all forms of hostilities near the Ukrainian border. And a spokesman for the United Nations said the UN is aware of the reports but has not verified them independently. European Union foreign ministers are holding emergency talks aimed at forming a unified response to helping Kurdish forces fight Islamic extremists in Iraq. The meeting in Brussels comes a day after Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki gave in to international pressure to step aside and support his nominated replacement, Haider al-Abadi. On Wall Street, U.S. stock indexes are down at this hour. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight...
The Ebola outbreak in West Africa has killed at least 1,000 people and sickened twice as many. Liberia and Sierra Leone, the two hardest hit countries at the moment, have reported at least 182 new cases in the past week. But the World Health Organization calls the outbreak vastly underestimated. Public health authorities in affected countries say they need more resources as they scramble to stop the spread of the disease and isolate those already infected.
That's VOA's Ann Look reporting. We'll have the latest on the Ebola outbreak coming up. Also, a U.S. doctor expresses concern over treating Ebola with an untested drug. There's word today of another mass kidnapping in northern Nigeria. And heavy fighting breaks out in Mogadishu today between Somali government forces, supported by AU troops, and a militia loyal to a former warlord. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from the DRC, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the Ebola outbreak in West Africa has killed at least 1,000 people and sickened twice as many. Liberia and Sierra Leone, the two hardest hit countries at the moment, have reported at least 182 new cases in the past week. But the World Health Organization calls the outbreak vastly underestimated. Public health authorities in affected countries say they need more resources as they scramble to stop the spread of the disease and isolate those already infected. VOA West Africa correspondent Ann Look has more.
In Monrovia, Doctors Without Borders is building its largest Ebola treatment center yet. It will have 120 beds. MSF also runs a treatment unit in the northern border town of Foya in Lofa County. The group's emergency coordinator, Lindis Hurum, said it's still not enough.
Unfortunately, neither of these two units will be sufficient to cover for the need to isolate and care for the patients. Because at this stage, the outbreak is totally out of control, and we need to come up with other strategies to cope with the situation.
The Liberian Health Ministry says it is rolling out a new strategy to manage the high volume of suspected cases in the most affected counties, Lofa and Monserrato. Assistant Health Minister Tolbert Nyansua says health workers will go to the patients instead of the other way around.
Making sure that we work with the household members so that that patient cannot infect other household members and provide them with some level of care at the household level. And also, if there are too many patients in the community, we can move them into a community structure like a school building that can be reconditioned, provide mattresses, provide feeding, hygiene kits to them, and health promotion kits that we can manage the people until they can transition to a treatment unit.
He said the way to stop this outbreak is prevention. He said they have to stop infected or possibly infected people from passing the disease to family members and neighbors. The regional Ebola outbreak began in southeastern Guinea early this year. It jumped across the borders into Liberia and Sierra Leone, where it multiplied in rural areas. Both countries began seeing a surge in cases in June. In August, Liberia and Sierra Leone enacted emergency rule and quarantined the most affected districts. Security forces have set up roadblocks and shut borders. In the Kenema district of Sierra Leone, security forces have stopped movement in or out. Residents say the measures are drastic and they are pushing up food prices, but that they are also necessary and overdue.
When the first time we heard about Ebola, if the measures that are in place now was in place, I want to believe, we should have not reached the peak we are presently in.
Public health officials say an Ebola outbreak can be contained, but it has to be snuffed out like a forest fire. No embers can be left to burn. Authorities must isolate confirmed and suspected cases. They must then monitor everyone who may have been exposed to a patient's bodily fluids for 21 days, the incubation period of the disease. If any one of those people shows symptoms, they go into isolation as well. But this is proving easier said than done. Nigeria, for example, has been monitoring nearly 200 contacts related to just one confirmed case, the country's first, an air traveler from Liberia who died in Lagos in late July. In Liberia and Sierra Leone, even as quarantine measures have slowed the large-scale movement of people outside their communities, authorities say the sheer number of cases and contacts to trace is overwhelming. Sierra Leone's Health Minister Miata Carbo says they need more logistical support.
We need ambulances, we need vehicles for contact tracing and surveillance. You may have the funds, but the ambulances are not available. So this is a challenge that we do have. So the logistical support, what is needed to support the fight against Ebola, needs to come faster than we're seeing from the international community.
Public health experts say it will likely be months before the outbreak is over. Never have there been so many cases of Ebola in so many places at once. The international head of Doctors Without Borders said Friday that Liberia remains a particular problem. She said stabilizing the outbreak there is key for the whole region. Anne Look, VOA News, Dakar.
Thank you. And the international president of Doctors Without Borders warns the number of confirmed Ebola cases and deaths is likely to be just the tip of the iceberg. The chief of the medical aid group says it will take at least 6 months to bring the epidemic in West Africa under control. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The head of Doctors Without Borders, Joanne Liu, spoke to reporters after returning from a 10-day visit to Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. She says the Ebola epidemic raging in these three countries makes them feel like wartime. She says the fear is palpable and nobody understands what is going on. Liu says there has been a total collapse of infrastructure in the Ebola-affected countries since the disease was first discovered in Guinea in March. She says 80 healthcare workers have died from Ebola and 170 have been infected. She tells VOA the three countries are in different stages of the epidemic.
In terms of stability, I think that in Guinea, because they've been dealing with this for 5 months, they have more measures being put in places and they have more capacity and as well a greater understanding of what's going on. Whereas for Sierra Leone and Liberia, they only started to have cases for the last few weeks.
While infections in both Sierra Leone and Liberia continue to grow at a steady rate, she says the situation in Liberia is the most dangerous.
If we don't stabilize Liberia, we'll never stabilize the whole region. So that's today one of the places that needs to have fast and quick action.
Dr. Liu says more coordinated action is needed to bring the epidemic under control in West Africa. She says many more experts in disaster management are needed in the field and that surveillance of those who had contact with Ebola patients must be strengthened. She also says people must be taught how Ebola is spread and how they can protect themselves. And she says there needs to be greater leadership from the World Health Organization.
A strong leadership from WHO is mandatory and stronger than what they have done so far. They are scaling up. They need to scale up more. I know the DG is on this, but it needs to happen centrally and at the decentralized way as well.
The WHO has tallied more than 1,000 deaths and nearly 2,000 cases of Ebola in four West African countries this year. But Dr. Liu says many more cases than that go unreported. Some patients have resisted entering hospitals and isolation wards, preferring to entrust their care to family members. Liu believes the epidemic will continue to grow for some time before it is brought under control. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. As the death toll from the Ebola virus continues to soar throughout West Africa, an experimental serum created to treat Ebola was given to two American missionaries who at present appear to be improving in the U.S. The drug was also sent to treat a Spanish priest, but he did not recover and died this past Tuesday. One U.S. doctor says that is the problem with experimental drugs. They have never been clinically tested in humans. One does not know whether or not they will work and on whom do they work. Dr. Philip M. Rosoff is professor of pediatrics and medicine and the director of the clinical ethics program at Duke University Hospital in the U.S. state of North Carolina. He spoke with me about the ethics of using an untested Ebola drug.
Well, I think the ramifications are similar to the ramifications of giving any kind of experimental treatment when you haven't tested it in humans before. There are certainly the risks of unanticipated toxicities. There are also the risks of, in this particular case, and in approaching this situation the way that it has been recommended, is that you will not find out if the drug is effective or if it is ineffective.
If the patient is willing to take this type of risk, they're in a position where they're looking at what do they have to lose at this point?
I think that one has to approach desperate situations like this with a great deal of caution, care, and thoughtfulness. Desperate people are willing to take desperate measures to save their lives or the lives of their loved ones. And those who would hold out hope to those desperate people need to take great care that the hope is not portrayed in an inappropriate or unrealistic manner. It would be impossible to know if this drug is effective up front, since no experiments, as far as I understand, have been done to show that it is effective in people, or not effective for that matter.
ZMapp is the U.S.-produced untested drug that will be given to doctors in Liberia first, and then it's going to be decided who else will be receiving the drug. So how do doctors go about deciding who is going to get this untested drug?
In a realistic way, this should be done with as much consensus, transparency, and openness and honesty as possible. Ideally, the people who have control over this drug, that is assuming that you have already decided that it is okay, ethically okay, and medically okay to administer this drug. This is a classic rationing problem, and you have to decide to whom to administer it. These kinds of decisions should not be made behind closed doors, but should be expeditiously managed and discussed openly about how the rationing choice will be made. One could, for instance, make an argument that you should treat healthcare workers first because you can't take care of the sick if there are no healthcare workers to take care of them. This would also potentially encourage healthcare workers to volunteer to take care of these patients. These were some of the considerations that were discussed several years ago when preparing for an influenza pandemic, when discussing influenza vaccine, who should get the first lots of vaccine. Other considerations are, should you give this to the sickest people first, or should you give it to those who might be thought medically to have the best opportunity to survive? And perhaps they might not be the sickest people. But these are the kinds of discussions that should be held. Now, if you identify a class of people that you think should be eligible for the drug as first line, and there's still more of them than you have available for drug, there's a variety of different ways that one can decide which of those people should get it. Some people think that a lottery or a coin toss mechanism is the fairest. Other people think first in line, first come, first served, might be the fairest. The problem with first come, first served is that tends to privilege people who can get there first, and sometimes that's people who have access to information or access to transportation. The point I'm trying to make is that this needs to be considered very, very carefully and transparently so everyone knows what the rules are and can agree to them.
Also, in one of your quotes, you'd raise the concern that perhaps this untested drug, the first people to receive this were white Americans or white Europeans. So do you think this can be viewed as a preferential treatment in this particular case with Ebola?
Well, I think the question is both whether it is preferential treatment and whether it can be viewed as preferential treatment even if it isn't. Western countries, and particularly Western pharmaceutical firms, have a long history, and not a particularly reputable history, of testing drugs in African populations and then taking those results of their tests and their clinical trials and selling drugs to rich Western countries. A lot has changed in that behavior over the years, but I think people are still extremely sensitive about this. But this, again, brings up the question as who should receive the first lots of this drug? Should it be the people, many of whom are Westerners, taking care of the sick people who are affected by Ebola, or should it be the patients themselves? Once again, this has to be discussed in an open and transparent manner.
Dr. Philip M. Rosoff is professor of pediatrics and medicine. He also directs the clinical ethics program at Duke University Hospital in the U.S. state of North Carolina. You can find more of Dr. Rosoff's research in his just-released book, Rationing is Not a Four-Letter Word, Setting Limits on Healthcare. Twenty minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. There's word today of another mass kidnapping in northern Nigeria. Media reports say residents of the remote village of Duron Baga say as many as 97 civilians are missing. Villagers who escaped reached the city of Maiduguri today. They told reporters that Boko Haram fighters attacked the village last Sunday. They say the militants abducted dozens of boys and men, loaded them into the trucks, and then drove away. The attackers also killed at least six other men and burned homes. The attack is a reminder of the kidnapping of several hundred girls in April in Chibok, another town in Borno State. Most of the girls are still missing. Boko Haram has been waging an insurgency in the state for 5 years to create an Islamic State. Flooding in central and western Niger has killed at least 12 people and left about 4,000 in need of food and clean water. The humanitarian advisor for Niger's prime minister says the floods are caused by heavy rains. About half of the victims are receiving food aid from the government and the UN. Niger has been struck by alternating drought and flooding in recent years. Heavy fighting broke out in the Somali capital early today when government and African Union forces attacked fighters loyal to a former warlord. Witnesses and officials say at least 10 people were killed in the Wadajir neighborhood of southwest Mogadishu. Ahmed Hassan Adal told VOA Somali Service that clashes began when government forces attacked his home before dawn. The AU force says it was trying to secure an arms cache when his militia attacked. It said the fighters were overpowered and 20 people were arrested. 15 guns and ammunition were also seized. An AU force spokesman says Adal, better known as Ahmed Dai, escaped from his house and that Somali and AU forces are chasing him. Twenty-two minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, locally made aluminum pots and pans are very common in Africa and Asia, but a new study in Cameroon raises questions about their safety. It says high levels of lead are leaking from the cookware into food. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The World Health Organization has not posted any regulations regarding lead in cookware, but the U.S. Centers for Disease Control says there's really no safe level of lead exposure. Ashland University and Occupational Knowledge International conducted the research in Cameroon that appears in the journal Science of the Total Environment. Perry Gottesfeld is Occupational Knowledge International's executive director.
I must say we literally stumbled upon this. We were working in Cameroon for the past 4 years. We had been doing awareness sessions and outreach around lead in paint, trying to get companies there to reformulate, to take out the lead additives and to get government to put in regulation. And in the process, the question had come up, well, what about the pots?
The lead awareness campaign was done in partnership with the Education Center for Development, a Cameroonian NGO.
Our partners went out and visited where these are made and reported back that, in fact, this is made primarily from scrap metal. And so that, of course, piqued our interest, and that's when we decided to do an investigation to find out what the levels of lead and other heavy metals were in those pots.
The researchers wanted to know how much lead was being served with daily meals. Gottesfeld says lead exposure has effects that are both acute and chronic.
We found that the average or median level was about 97 micrograms of lead per serving, serving size being about 250 milliliters. So this is a very high concentration of lead and a type of exposure that people would likely get on a regular daily basis if using this kind of cookware.
That's hundreds of times higher than the level the U.S. state of California has determined to be the maximum allowable dose per day.
In terms of low-level lead health effects that occur on an ongoing basis like this one, we could expect neurological damage that's manifested in reduced performance in school, reduced IQ, and other learning disabilities. We also know, though, that it affects the health of an individual throughout their life and does result in higher rates of heart disease and stroke, and it does result in a very high death rate amongst populations who are exposed long-term.
Gottesfeld says there are reports that similar lead levels are found in locally made aluminum cookware in Thailand and Bangladesh. He says taking steps to eliminate the lead-laced pots pose challenges.
I think the first question we need to ask is, how extensive is this problem? But ultimately, I think it's going to require some regulation on the part of government, but also it's going to require working with these local manufacturers to educate them about the kinds of scrap metal that they should and shouldn't use in making this kind of cookware.
He says the scrap metal could be tested for lead before it's melted down to make cookware. This could be done with a portable device called X-ray fluorescence, or XRF, which gives results in a matter of seconds. Researchers are considering a pilot project to determine whether on-site testing is feasible in Cameroon. Another option is to have the cookware manufactured with a process called anodization. It places a coating on aluminum that reduces the amount of lead and other metals leaching into food.
We know that lead poisoning is a huge problem throughout Africa, but almost all of it goes undetected because there are no facilities to test for blood lead levels in most countries in Africa. So we know that there are literally millions of children and adults who are overexposed to lead, and they just continue to suffer with these symptoms, and they're often misdiagnosed with some other unrelated disease.
Occupational Knowledge International recommends that African laboratories have the capacity to conduct tests for blood lead levels. Field tests are also available. Gottesfeld says awareness campaigns are needed for those who run the small companies that manufacture the pots.
We would like to follow up by doing more outreach and education with these manufacturers so that they better understand the kinds of scrap that contain higher levels of lead and other contaminants. Clearly, if they were using pure aluminum, this would not be a problem.
He says recent surveys in Africa and Asia suggest blood lead levels have remained stubbornly high, despite the ban on lead gasoline in most of the world. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Health Network, a multimedia network reaching 50 million Africans weekly. We bring you relevant, reliable health news and information. We ask you about the health problems most important to you and inform you about health problems impacting your community. VOA Africa Health Network. Visit our website at www.africahealthnetwork.com.
Love African music?
Music time in Africa.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900, 2000 and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Heavy fighting breaks out in Mogadishu today between Somali government forces supported by AU troops and a militia loyal to a former warlord. The WHO says reported outbreaks of the Ebola virus that is spreading through West Africa are vastly underestimated. And a U.S. doctor expresses concern over treating Ebola with an untested drug. Coming up, music from the DRC and the final part of our series on traditional African chiefs. I'm Kim Lewis and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're beginning with boxing this evening.
Kim, it's time to climb between the ropes once again with our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moeta. Good evening, Namdi.
And a good evening, Sunny.
Namdi, I know you like to say styles make fights, and this one on Saturday night looks like a great one in terms of styles. Sakio the Scorpion Bika, known as one of the biggest brawlers in professional boxing, takes on Anthony Durrell of the United States. It's a WBC super middleweight title rematch. When these two fought last December, it ended in a draw. It's going to be in your backyard pretty much, Namdi, south of L.A. Talk about the fight.
Sonny, count on me to be ringside for this brawl, because 9 months ago, this guy went into a brutal fight. Durrell had Bika down in the fifth round, and Bika was almost out.
Mm.
But he came back strong in the sixth round, and even that sixth round went down as one of the rounds of the year. You know, so first one was a brutal fight, and it took this guy 9 months just to cool off, Sonny.
So you're expecting another action-packed fight, Namdi?
I will expect Durrell to box Sakio Bika, not to go toe-to-toe, because if he decides to go toe-to-toe, then he may get dropped, because Sakio Bika is a big banger, and if you get into his corner, he can drop you. But the Sakio himself, you know, he can be dropped too, so it's a 50-50 blowout.
Namdi, talk a little bit about the Scorpion Bika. He's from Cameroon, and yet he's now based in Australia.
Yeah, he's based in Australia, but the media in Australia don't really give him no juice at all. They don't really write about him. They ignore him. They concentrate on the other Australian fighters. He's not a draw in Australia. He comes out to the U.S. to fight. But he's lucky he has a good manager in Al Haymon. So he gets to fight on Showtime. He gets to make good money. But in Australia, nobody knows him. Even in Africa, we rarely hear about Sakio, the Scorpion Bika.
Namdi, if Bika can prevail in this rematch, what's down the road for him?
Well, he's talking about moving up into the light heavyweight division, because it looks like that's where the money is right now, with the execution and the damage in all those young cats. You know, you're sure to make some very good figure money in the fight game. But, you know, in the game, we consider Sakio Bika to be a dirty fighter, you know, which means during the fight, he can drop you with a low blow. And he's a big puncher, so not everybody really wants to go in and tangle with him, you know. Dirty fighter can do any dirty thing in the fight, so you don't really fight him unless you really want to take away his belt, or unless he's a mandatory fight for you. So he's a dangerous puncher. Yeah.
Namdi, you talk about how Bika has been known to throw low blows. Does he like to make it ugly? I mean, does he have a better chance of winning if it turns into a brawl?
It reminds me of those fights I used to watch at the motor park in Lagos, Nigeria, where there's no style to it. So hit me, I hit you, you know. No defense, you know. The lucky guy connects, and when the lucky guy connects, the fight is almost over because the other guy has no defense, you know. So it's anybody's fight. He's a dangerous puncher, but he's also a one-dimensional fighter. You know, if he can box him, he'll be trying to knock you out with that one big punch all night. In the meantime, you can run away with a decision.
Like I always say, for every fight, everybody had a game plan. As of right now, there's not a blueprint on how to beat Floyd Mayweather. No one has found the way to break the Mayweather code.
Floyd Money Mayweather, Namdi, the biggest name in boxing, back in the ring next month for a rematch against Argentina's Marcos Maidana. Mayweather Maidana 2, Namdi. How's that one shaping up?
Well, Sonny, it's at the Grand Casino in the MGM in Las Vegas, September 13th. Well, the pay-per-view numbers for the first one did not come out.
Why is that, Namdi?
Well, if the pay-per-view numbers don't come out a week after the fight, that means he didn't hit it, you know. I mean, there are talks about not even making $1 million, not even making 700,000 buys. You know, the fans are tired, really. You're telling us to drop $70 just to see a fight, and you look around, the guy we want to see you fight, Manny Pacquiao, is fighting a nobody. And, you know, the fight fans are tired. So they're not drawing out there to put $70 or pay $100 at closed circuit, run to the casino. But they still will draw, but don't expect it to make $1 million or $2 million buy. But it's going to be a good fight. The first fight, a lot of people felt that Marcos Maidana won. A lot of people felt that Mayweather did enough to retain his title. But don't expect him, Sonny, to go toe-to-toe this time around, you know. No, he's not that stupid and dumb. He will go there and box and steal the decision and run away.
So you see the fight being in the center of the ring rather against the ropes?
No, he can do no rope-a-dope. Rope-a-dope, Maidana has the capability to break his ribs, man. So you rope-a-dope the second time, you may end up with broken rib or broken jaw, you know. So for a pretty boy, he wants to look pretty after the fight, you know. So you better don't do no rope-a-dope in the second fight because this cat can break his jaw, you know. So you better just make it easy. Box, hold, run. The fans will like it. The fans will boo at the end of it, but he will walk home with another 30, 40 million bucks in the bank.
Well, Namdi, enjoy the Bika-Durrell rematch on Saturday night.
I look forward to the big one, Sonny. The scorpion from Africa better sting. All right, Sonny.
Thanks, Namdi.
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
Turning to African athletics, South Africa topped the medals table at the 19th African Championships, which ended Thursday in Marrakesh, Morocco. On the final day of action, an athlete from Botswana showed once again why he's Africa's best in the high jump. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman Mark Ouma reports.
Botswana's Kabelo Hosimang cleared the bar at 2.28 meters to win the men's high jump for an unprecedented fourth consecutive outing. Eunice Sum, Janeth Jepkoske and Agatha Jeruto secured a 1-2-3 Kenyan sweep in women's 800 meters. South African Wenda Nell won women's 400-meter hurdles. Djibouti's Ayanla Suleiman triumphed in 1,500 meters and Kenyan Caleb Ndiku carried the day in men's 5,000 meters. Ivory Coast's Muriel Lahore and Wilfred Kofi bagged gold medals in women's and men's 200 meters as Ethiopian Hiwota Eleo won women's 3,000-meter steeplechase. Cameroon's Joelle Mbumi and Sally Ndongmo triumphed in women's triple jump and shot put, respectively. Kenyan Julius Yego retained the men's javelin crown. South African Lebohang Shange and Kenyan Grace Wanjiru won the men's and women's 20-kilometer race walking, respectively. Botswana and Nigeria clinched the gold medal in men's and women's 4x400-meter relays, respectively. Staying in Marrakesh, South Africa amassed 10 gold, 5 silver, and 4 bronze medals to top the medal table at the championship. Nigeria are second, Kenya is third, followed by Ivory Coast, Botswana, Cameroon, Burkina Faso, Ethiopia, Morocco, Egypt, Tunisia, Algeria, Eritrea, Djibouti, Ghana, and Mauritius, while Senegal and Zambia tie in 17th spot as Republic of Congo and Namibia share the 19th spot. I'm Mark Omer, wishing you all a sporty weekend.
Because this is Africa. This time for Africa.
I'm very excited.
Because this is Africa. Time for Africa.
Now let's go to Barcelona, Spain, where Luis Suarez trained with his Barcelona teammates on Friday after the Court of Arbitration for Sport lifted a ban on the Uruguayan star from any football-related activity. Our VOA football fans will remember the 27-year-old Suarez received a 4-month ban from FIFA for biting Italian defender Giorgio Chiellini during a World Cup match June 24th. Uruguay's Football Association intervened on Suarez's behalf, asking that he be allowed to train during the 4-month period. Suarez remains ineligible to play in official Barca matches, and his 9-game international ban also remains in effect during the 4-month period. However, Suarez could possibly play in a Barca local tournament on Monday before his official presentation on Tuesday. Luis Suarez led the English Premier League in scoring last season when he played for Liverpool with 31 goals. Barcelona acquired him last month in a deal reportedly worth $75 million, making him one of the most expensive footballers in the world. The Desert Foxes of Algeria are Africa's highest-ranked team in monthly rankings released Thursday by FIFA, World Football's governing body. The Algerians, who reached the World Cup's round of 16 for the first time ever in Brazil, are at number 24 overall. The Elephants of Ivory Coast are one place back at number 25 overall, followed by Nigeria at 33, Ghana at 36, and Egypt at 38. Lesotho was the biggest African mover in the August FIFA rankings, rising 26 places from July to number 105 overall. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And today, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America. Well, coming up in our series on traditional African rulers, we'll profile the new generation of Cameroon's kings. And Christian groups in Sudan say the government is destroying their churches and preventing them from building new ones. First, here's Tabule of the DRC with Paquita.
Paquita, fidele yo, que volvas pronto. vaquita para bien, que tu madre te garda home. Esto es tu espera, quiero que creces pronto. Vaquita, gracias, tu clava es mi. Vaquita, fidele yo, que volvas pronto. Vaquita, gracias, tu clava es mi. Vaquita, fidele yo, que volvas pronto. Estoy herido por la flecha de tu belleza y disimulo. Venos en de mi corazón, está pronto, bella Vaquita. Vaquita, gracias, tu clava es mi. Vaquita, fidele yo, que volvas pronto. Vaquita, gracias, tu clava es mi. Vaquita, fidele yo, que volvas pronto.
With Vaquita. While many traditional rulers still wield a lot of power in Cameroon, yet they also have to submit themselves to many restrictions imposed by the throne. Once crowned, they have to abandon everything and return to the village to rule over their kingdoms. But a growing number are ignoring the old practice and moving out to pursue professional and academic careers elsewhere from Yaoundé. Reporter Eugene Nforgwa sits down with King Kevin Shomatang II of Mabyukum before the king leaves for classes.
King Kevin Shomatang II of Mabyukum leaves two lives. One involves bright-colored regalia, indescribable headgear, leopard skins, elephant tusk, and dozens of black statuettes. The other involves smartphones, laptops, iPads, books, and assignments. The first is a traditional life. As ruler of Bambalan, a small kingdom in northwestern Cameroon, Shomatang II is a powerful political figure, the custodian of a rich culture, and the spiritual leader of more than 45,000 people. The second is an academic life. A student at the School of Public Administration in Yaoundé, Shomatang II has joined a growing number of traditional chiefs that are embracing modernity, often leaving their thrones behind to pursue professional and academic life in the cities. Shomatang II describes himself as a modern traditional ruler. He says he tries to promote inclusive governance and is working to demystify the godlike persona of the king.
In the past, a traditional ruler was seen like the almighty, like the god of the people. He is actually, the people see him like God. In the years, when the fawn was the sole person to do everything, he had to take all the decisions all alone. It doesn't cancel the fact that the fawn is the overall leader or is the spiritual leader. It doesn't cancel that fact. This approach now involves so many people in decision making so that ideas are shared at all levels.
At Somini Yaoundé, a fourth floor flat in a middle class residential neighborhood, the clash between tradition and modernity is inevitable. There is an armchair covered in thick red cloth, a leopard skin, and a black stool. But there are no bear-skinned aides or elderly men bending over to recite praise to the king. Instead, several young men are downloading music on a laptop, a task that is frequently interrupted by the buzz of cell phones. It's just after sunset on the last Tuesday of May 2014 when Shomatang II drops a bunch of keys on the carved stool. Without a word, he lowers himself into the covered armchair. His feet rest on the sun-dried leopard skin with shrinking edges. His presence appears to fill the room, and everyone leaves. The stool, the red cloth, and the leopard skin are the only signs of royalty in the cramped sitting room. Nothing else gives away the power and authority bestowed on him. He shares the building with other tenants. Shamitang too tries his best to look like the king he really is. He does not give or take handshakes. The young men bow each time they come close. Once he's there, everyone speaks in barely audible mumbles and only enter the room if invited. The scene feels awkward because for all the royal trappings, this king is dressed in sneakers and a sweatshirt. The throne of Bambalam, as he is better known, was crowned in 2009. At the time, he was an economics major at the University of Boya, a student who liked jeans, t-shirts and relaxed dressing. Today, he is revered and feared by his people. His functions include saying prayers to the ancestors and settling disputes in the community. He is so powerful that he is referred to as God. But since he was crowned, Shamitang II has been more or less an absentee king. After completing his economics degree, he is studying to become a civil administrator. When he finishes next year, his job is likely to take him further and further away from his village. For traditional chiefs like Shamitang II, who are pursuing other dreams out of their kingdoms, the price to pay is often huge. It frequently includes living behind huge palaces in reverence to share tiny flats with total strangers in the city, or taking orders from ordinary people like teachers and supervisors. Shamitang too says the sacrifice is worth it.
When funds move out, funds get to know so many people, funds get to know, have so many friends out within the nation and even out of the country who can come bring development to the village. I have friends in Canada because of the fact that I am a fun. If the fundum was not open, if I was not learned enough, if I was not, if I didn't approach them well, I would not have this great relationship with them. So you go out of the village, fetch, go back and develop the village.
There is not much he can do to change an institution that has served his people for centuries. When he was enthroned, he was obliged to take many more wives and inherit the surviving women of his ancestors. He goes everywhere with a hat because no one is allowed to see his head. Outside his palace, in the bus or other public places, his chair must be covered because he does not share seats with non-kings. Von Shamitang too says he found these restrictions that come with the throne too overwhelming. In fact, he tried to escape several times when he was chosen to succeed his father, King Foseyok Komtor, but he has since accepted his fate and is trying to leave a legacy of his own. Reporting for VOA Africa, I am Eugene Fongwa in Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Christ Church in Khartoum was demolished last month because it was built illegally, said the government. Christian groups in Sudan say the government is destroying their churches and preventing them from building new ones. The government denies these accusations. VOA reporter Nabil Biagio reports from Washington about the church controversy in Sudan.
When Christ Church in Khartoum was demolished, the government said it was torn down because it was built on land that belonged to someone else and was not zoned for a church. Sudan's Minister of Guidance and Religious Endowments, Shalil Abdullah, announced that the government will not allow more churches to be built in Sudan. Sudan's Christian minority, which makes up 5% of the population, says the destruction of Christ Church and the ban on building new churches is a sign that the government is violating their freedom of religion. Reverend Romla Kuri Kuku is the General Secretary of Sudan's Council of Churches.
As Christians, we have right to build the churches and we want the government to give us the plots, because that church which is destroyed in Khartoum North is has a right, of course, to give them their land so that they can build the church. We are not foreigners, we are citizens.
Kuku cited another example that he says shows that Christians are not free to practice their religion. He says security officers burst into a workshop he attended at Sudan University in Khartoum when the audience of Muslims and Christians began reciting verses from the Bible and the Quran. The security forces accused the workshop participants of preaching Christianity and shut down the event.
This makes me to realize that also they have banned preaching the word of God. This is what I understood actually.
Sudan's Christian community consists mainly of people from the Nuba Mountains, Coptic groups and South Sudanese who have remained in Sudan since their country became an independent nation in 2011. Sudanese Christians complain that they are harassed by the government and are not treated as equal citizens. But Sudan's Information Minister Ahmed Bilal says Christians in Sudan are free to practice their religion. Only South Sudanese who live in Sudan but are not citizens are barred from building new churches, he says.
But for our citizens from the Nuba, from the Coptic, if they want to build a church, there is no problem. Only they needed to take a permission.
Bilal denies that the government is discriminating against Christians.
We have no problem with the Christian minority in Sudan. The annual Ramadan breakfast attended by the president and all the ministers in the church. And we are living together with the Coptics. There is no problem at all, I assure you for that.
But he says there are enough Christian churches in Sudan already, and anyone who wants to build a new one has to get written permission from the government. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The leaders of South Sudan and the armed opposition challenging their authority have again failed to live up to their pledge to form a transitional government and end the fighting that has badly split the East African nation. The United States, along with its Troika colleagues from Norway and the United Kingdom, condemns the continued foot-dragging over negotiating a political settlement. Deadlines keep passing and innocent people keep dying. It is both an outrage and insult to the people of South Sudan. The South Sudanese government and the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition agreed to a 60-day time frame in which to form a transitional government of national unity. That deadline passed August 10th. Regional leaders helped broker the agreement, but despite the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, mediation team's best efforts for more than 6 months, neither party engaged in peace talks seriously, nor committed to inclusive negotiations. Over a million people have been displaced by the fighting, and the nation faces the worst food security crisis in the world. Meanwhile, recent attacks in Maban County have resulted in the deaths of at least 6 humanitarian workers. Innocent civilians may have been systematically murdered based on their ethnicity. These killings further undermine the enormous humanitarian response needed to support the millions of South Sudanese in desperate need of life-saving food assistance and living in constant fear of violence. This crisis was not caused by drought or flood. It is a man-made calamity created by conflict. Regional leaders have previously called for punitive measures if the parties fail to secure peace by the agreed deadline. IGAD and the African Union should take immediate, appropriate action to help bring that about. The United States stands with the people of South Sudan. As the crisis continues and the threat of famine grows, our government will provide an additional $180 million in food aid. President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar must assume their responsibilities to prevent further needless suffering.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Africa Health Network, a multimedia network reaching 50 million Africans weekly. We bring you relevant, reliable health news and information. We ask you about the health problems most important to you and inform you about health problems impacting your community. VOA Africa Health Network. Visit our website at www.africahealthnetwork.com.
The Voice of America, VOA.